Welcome back again to what will be the weekend edition of Red Star Radio, this time coming to you with a very special guest joining us for a conversation today. And I'll, without further ado, throw over to Layla, who is going to introduce said guest.
So we're very pleased to be speaking with Angela Nagel, who is the author of Kill All Normies and has written in multiple journals, including The Washington Post and American Affairs. She has recently started writing on Substack over at angelanagel.substack.com. So thank you so much for joining us, Angela.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So we want to get you on because something me and Alex have been stressing out a lot about lately, especially with all of the stuff around COVID-19 and the way in which people have been censored and have been, slandered for just, expressing even mild dissenting opinions on COVID-19. And we've experienced this as well in our own lives, is just kind of the state of the intellectual environment and, the importance of free speech and all these different things. And I know this is something that you've experienced earlier than us, like when you came out with your kind of heterodox opinions a few years earlier. So something that really came to the fore for me especially is the state of the intellectual environment, from the natural to the social sciences. It's like very bad. I found that during COVID, scientists are not able to just describe what's going on anymore. Like, they're just able to reinforce propaganda a lot of the time. But, intellectuals from all fields of knowledge are not able to just do the bare minimum and explain and describe how society exists, like as it exists, let alone make any predictions as to how things are going to go. So a good example of this is, of course, the natural sciences being able to hardly being able to just describe the current state of the pandemic, but also making models that again and again fail to predict what's going to happen. A good example from the social sciences, of course, is Robert Paxton, who's quite a decorated historian of fascism, who came out a few months ago after the so-called coup on the Capitol, and to declare that Trump is actually could be described as a fascist, which is a reversal on his position that he put forward a few years ago when Trump was elected. So given the very sad state of the intelligentsia, what role do you think independent intellectual production can play, like so such as your own, in this kind of environment?
Yeah, well, it's always hard to know whether you try to stay within the institutions and reform them, or whether you just break from them completely and do something independent. The internet definitely has, well, I suppose in some ways it's made us more conformist and simultaneously opened up, at least for people who are willing to have a bit of courage, a kind of space for alternative points of view. But then the problem is, if everyone does that, there's nobody left in the institutions to say anything. So it's a very hard call to make. And I think it depends on, you have to judge yourself whether, if there's any hope in your field, then it probably is best to stay within the institutions and do what you can. Mm-hmm. But, if you're in something, if you're in a field where there's like absolutely, where it will be just entirely pointless, then yeah, I think it is best to go independent. And I mentioned to you guys Justin Murphy, who, I think like he's been talking about for years, he thinks that this is like a very viable thing actually, and going independent is going to be very viable, and that the institutions have gotten so bad that they have to basically suffer a full kind of legitimacy crash, basically. Mm-hmm. But also even economically, they're oversubscribed and they don't really even pay like they used to or anything like that. I think like an example that he used and others to make this argument uses the, if you trace the decline in the amount of money that publishers give for a book for an advance, and how much it has declined over the years and things like that. So In other words, like there are fewer benefits to staying within the institutions all the time. And, you know, like why would you want to toil for like your whole life just to push the debate just like an inch in the right direction, you know, when you can just go independent and then say more or less what you want. So yeah, that's kind of the call people have to make. I'm more inclined to say you have to go independent because it is beyond a point of return, I think, for many institutions. I mean, even something like Josh Hawley getting his book cancelled or whatever, you know, like that's like a massive, like a political figure of like, you know, sort of,
yeah,
a very famous and sort of like elected political figure who, you know, if they are doing it to him, like what hope is there for a person who has no real contacts or power or, you know, elite networks or anything? I think going independent is the way forward.
Yeah, something I do wonder about. I think obviously, like my personal opinion is certainly within the social sciences, things have been depleted to a very bare amount. Just kind of viewing the way things have gone for the natural sciences, I think they're also holding on by a thread. But I don't want to comment too much because I'm not in that field. Something I do worry about is for independent producers and this move towards independent intellectual work is a lack of peer review. So part of the benefits of academia was being in an environment where you could speak freely with your colleagues and they could critique your work and show you, you know, like where you've gone wrong and where you've missed something and your blind spots. And I'm not sure how that will happen in a new kind of decentralized paradigm of intellectual production, you know?
Yeah. Also, the other thing is that that process was meant to take place among kind of, I guess in a like rarefied sort of environment that was somewhat impersonal, you know, like if somebody could critique your work just like they do in a PhD Viva or something like that. And it's not like a personal attack on you.
Yeah.
Whereas like when people go independent, sometimes there becomes a kind of cult of personality around the person who is an outspoken figure. And then the what should be impersonal critiques end up being personal attacks on them, and then you have like people sort of trying to like knock each other out in some way, like as almost like competitors, and that's not really how it should work either, you know. So it ends up being a big personalized fight rather than really trying to like seek truth. So that is also a huge problem. Yeah. And then because it's personalized, people will just cling to their position. So that's a huge problem too. It's hard to see how you could replicate that impersonal, like the function that peer review is supposed to serve, outside of that environment, you know?
Yeah. And I think part of the reason why it becomes so personal is because, whereas in academia, you know, and this is becoming less and less so, but traditionally you would have tenure, right? So an attack on your work did not equal an attack on your income. But if you go independent, an attack on your work, it becomes so personal because it becomes an attack directly on your income, which is tied to your person, not through some indifferent salary arrangement tenure is explicitly something that you're given regardless of what you do, what you produce type thing, at least, you know, in theory. Yeah, so it's I think it's difficult. I think Murphy, Justin Murphy that you, who you mentioned, I think it's true that things are changing, but yeah, it's hard to see in what direction it might go, like to kind of, I think the goal should be in this change to reinvigorate intellectual production, which I realize, especially during this pandemic, how important it was to have people who you know, who are able to stand aside and who don't have any vested interests and in what's going on and who's able to offer critique. So it's I think things are beginning rearranged, but I can see some downfalls to the current model as well.
I haven't, like, when I would see, you know, like news about some scientist who had a dissenting view on something about COVID, say, and then the next thing would be like an article with like a hit pic of them looking crazy, and it would say like, this person is just a deranged conspiracy theorist. And of course, we know, like with hit pieces, you can just basically find like somebody on a crazy forum somewhere reference their work, and then you can link them to that. You know what I mean? And you can make anyone look bad, basically. You can make anyone look crazy with one of these things. But you know, unless you're really invested in it, right, and you really are obsessed with finding out the truth of like where it came from and what the best policies are and so on, if you're sort of not going to do that, then like you don't have the time to personally go and research the whole biography of everyone who's commented on this, or to, you know, analyze every single article that's written to see, are there any weird NGOs like co-authoring this, you know, and so on. And so you kind of just tune out at a certain point. Like I have kind of tuned out to some degree, because it would be a full-time job for me to actually go and be sure like that I have an independent, like correct view.
Sure.
You know, the amount of work that it would take to do that. So I know in Ireland, for example, there's one lady who, you know, I the first thing I saw about her was one of these like hit pieces, who was basically anti-lockdown, to cut a long story short. And, you know, I still have no idea, you know, if she's like some sources said that, you know, she was like a very respected, like, you know, establishment sort of like very apolitical scientist. And then others, you know, others were saying the opposite. So, yeah, I mean, this is why you have to have these institutions, right? Because ordinary citizens don't have the time to personally go and uncover all of these things, you know, because as soon as the COVID thing passes, there'll be something else, you know. And unless you're like a full-time neat, you know, and you're going to just like obsessively research every single one of these things yourself, you have to rely on expert opinion, basically.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's difficult. I find that there's just so much, like, there's so many ad hominem attacks, like, which I find so frustrating, because even if someone has done something in the past and said something in the past, whatever, or is someone who is a contrarian usually, that doesn't necessarily invalidate what they're saying. Like, people still need to consider the argument on. And so, yeah, I think I guess, for lack of a better way of putting it, just the saturation of logical fallacies into our current environment writ large, it goes beyond whether someone is independent or not independent. Like, I think it's a societal issue, which I'm not prepared to fully comment on, but Alex, did you want to comment on anything?
Well, I think what we've seen is certainly over the last probably 13 to 14 years is probably the comprehensive annihilation of what Jürgen Habermas once called the public sphere, which was always a very limited concept in a capitalist society. But even like 15 years ago, when I was in my undergraduate years, like even back then, the intellectual climate was still stifled to a degree, because I was in a political science department dominated by thinkers who were all like ascribing to the wonderful theories of Anthony Giddens and New Labour, but which is a great way to spend 3 years of your life. But even back then, like, there were like there was a clear role for dissenting opinions inside, like, the different social sciences departments at the university I was at. And just from looking around now, like, you can see, like, that space close up rapidly over the last 10 years. And where the two sort of great, what I would describe as sort of bourgeois moral panics in British and American society, like Brexit in our case, Trump in the case of the United States, that seemed to really accelerate the process of decay, whereby every single issue was framed via, you know, pro or anti-Brexit, pro or anti-Trump, and every single critique that could be made of, like, the existing order, no matter where it came from, was if it touched on any area that, like, Brexit-aligned politicians had mentioned or Trump had mentioned, the so-called mainstream immediately had to attack it, destroy it, and discredit it, no matter where it came from or who was saying it. So, like, it seems that what's been completely withdrawn in this period is any ability for public reasoning, and also any ability for people to engage in trial and error. The idea that if you can be wrong on something and interrogate that position and learn from it, you're not allowed to do that in the public sphere anymore. You've got to be 100% aligned with this very rigorously enforced now establishment opinion. And that kind of seamlessly in this country rolled over from, like, Brexit into COVID, and now I don't know where it's going to go, but it seems that each of them became really a way for the ruling class to dramatically reinforce its own narratives, certainly with Brexit and COVID. And I think the same is true of the United States as well. Certainly it seemed that I think the whole Trump thing in the United States was probably worse even than the Brexit thing here, given the amount of just hysterical madness that poured out of that. I mean, we started doing this show just before around the time of the so-called 6th of January storming of the Capitol, which we did a show on it at the time and reflected that it seemed to be more like a sort of a pantomime than anything else. But if you read, like, the bourgeois press, it was like Mussolini's march on Rome, the siege of Madrid, the split up of the Spice Girls, and all manner of other horrors that was being visited on the innocent, quivering politicians of America, and thus American democracy itself, which is transparently mad and easily disproved. But it was asserted so hysterically over and over again that it just became, for some people anyway, a reality. And it just seemed that the possibilities of even basic disputation have now been removed.
Yeah, what's so weird about the Capitol thing too is that on the one hand, of course, it's true that the government is, like, exaggerating. You know, they didn't go in, march in with guns. They weren't an organized, like, political unit of any kind. There was a kind of weird innocence to it, and the fact that, like, they weren't even wearing masks, you know, or anything like that. Like, they weren't covering their identity. Clearly, they didn't really even think that this would happen on the day, and they kind of got carried away. But but at the same time, they still did storm the Capitol. Like, it's kind of funny. It's almost like some of them, because so many of them, like, didn't think this would happen or didn't think it through at all, probably, their attitude is almost like, was that wrong? Did we do something wrong? So, you know, the thing is, like, it is true that the elites are misrepresenting it, but at the same time, like, when you know, the masses are storming the Capitol, that's the point at which elites, like, really have to give a little bit of ground. Like, I don't think that you would see, even, for example, some of the capital gains tax, some of the more redistributive stuff that the Biden administration is now doing, I don't think you would see that if it weren't, if the elites weren't a little bit shook by that, you know, like I think that they have accepted to some degree that they have to give a little bit of ground or they'll lose their heads, you know.
Well, I think that the I think that there's various attempts from like the ruling classes of Britain and the United States, certainly since 2016, to look as if they're addressing like the rather transparent problems that are growing in the societies. But the remarkable, well, maybe not remarkable, the striking thing to me is that they'll be like rhetorical moves in a certain direction. Like even like Theresa May, who's a spectacularly useless politician, made like rhetorical moves towards like saying that she was going to address inequality, or like Boris Johnson and Rishi Sunak will say like, oh, we're going to establish a national investment bank and we're going to try and regenerate the north of England, that kind of thing. And then, you know, John McDonnell will go on the TV and cry that they've stolen these policies. But the thing that strikes me about all of this is the way this attempt then runs into like the various different class-dominated structures and institutional imperatives and seems to run out of steam even after the words have left the lips of the speaker. So I think that there's clearly some of them realize that they've got a bit of a problem, but I don't think that the alignment of forces in society has yet reached the point where they'll start pursuing that in all seriousness. I think that there's a rhetorical move, but I still think that the imperatives that exist there at the moment don't push them towards like, you know, or would push them towards like a sort of New Deal situation. Because I think one of the things that the last 5 to 6 years revealed is that like without a strong working class presence in the political sphere, that change doesn't happen. I don't think the middle class clearly can't do it.
If they just refuse, who is going to like push them to even allow kind of minor reforms?
Yeah. Layla, did you want to come back in?
I think there is something to be said though about especially when it comes to science, but also when it comes to, especially when it comes to the natural sciences, but also when it comes to the social sciences, I think a lack of dynamism, intellectual dynamism, and is detrimental to capital. And so while it may find itself unable to reinvigorate, the intellectual production and you know, which requires dissent in order to function properly, especially with science. Like with science, you need to constantly be challenging theories and hypotheses in order and testing and redoing experiments in order to verify what you've produced and to know if whether or not it matches up with empirical reality. I think that actually acts as a fettering force against the ruling class's ability to operate. And so despite itself, despite what it may or may not do, I think that the inherent lack of dynamism that comes with the fettering of intellectual production and therefore the fettering of production writ large will cause it to kind of come back in order to you know, function properly. So I think that will be because of the things change and the working classes gain more and more ability to reinsert themselves into politics. But yeah, I think there is something to be said about the detrimental effects of the lack of intellectual dynamism to the ruling class even.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. I mean, I think one of the ways that they've gotten this far is that basically is kind of the immigration model in a way, because the big powers basically poach the experts from all around the world. They can bring in like a ready-made army of engineers, basically. Like any company can do that by just bringing them all to London or New York or California. And so they've probably been able to make up for a certain amount of the lack of dynamism with that. But even that runs out because if you bring somebody in, like say you bring, you know, you have a tech company or something and you bring in a bunch of brilliant experts from India and China, well, if they're not allowed to work in a and think in a free way, and everything is intensely politicized, it's not really going to work. So maybe I also have to think that these tech companies, like, there must be people high up in the tech companies that see that it's not going to be a good thing to to pack your workforce with these ideologues, you know, who are going to be terrible at their job and who are going to be, like, you know, me tooing everyone and, you know, like, just like making it impossible. But you then also have these weird, like, bug unions, these pseudo unions that are appearing among kind of technical professionals, where they even say, like, their goal is not to get better wages, it's to ensure that the tech companies correctly censor everyone.
Yeah, I mean, that's like a then as farce type thing for the unions, I think, that union.
That makes the old civil service union I used to be in look good by comparison.
That makes it that, yeah, I think you're correct. Like, I think, though, like, the problem with capitalism is that it cannot deal with its contradictions except through crisis. It can just move them around. It can delay the crisis. It can move it around a little bit, like, as with, for instance, the bringing in of intelligentsia via immigration, which is a great example, actually. I think very good analogy. So my thoughts is that these I think that the managers of these places are true believers, actually. Like, I've after interacting with so many doctors and scientists when I was researching for COVID-19, like, these folks are true believers. Like, they have no doubt at all that what they're doing is correct. In fact, they believe it's correct and that they're helping people. And I think that I suspect that these folks are also kind of in the same mind frame. They believe that they're absolutely correct and they're helping society as well. I think the bourgeoisie, like the high bourgeoisie, probably has a few more skeptical, cynical people, but I actually don't think the ruling class is all that intelligent, to be honest. I think that they're an irrational bunch. And so I don't think they really think through things through. I think they're very, especially at this point with the large fictitious capital bubbles, like the large asset bubbles, and the precarity of finance right now with the asset bubbles, it's made them extremely irrational. Something me and Alex have discussed a lot.
I mean, I guess building institutions outside of this world from scratch, obviously that's very difficult, it has to be the way to go. And also, because of this whole kind of elite overproduction environment in which everyone's so scrambling to, you know, take down, like, somebody who's recently, you know, been successful. So and you know, everyone's kind of taking down everyone all the time. That has to stop too, because I think there has to be some kind of spirit of solidarity among people who are trying to start new institutions or break out of the existing ones, even among people who don't agree, you know, but who just agree that those things have to exist. And for that to happen, sometimes I find, like, even among kind of dissenting voices, there's this really shitty kind of resentful, narcissistic tendency to, you know, always, like, yeah, they'll like attack someone who is trying to do something new and who is trying to be constructive and to create an alternative space for ideas and stuff like that. there's always a new little bunch of people who will try to take them down. I think, anyway, the point is basically, if you are anyone who has broken out of the institutions and who is trying to build alternative institutions, who's trying to create the infrastructure for independent voices to exist, if you don't, like, you don't have to just, like, destroy them if you disagree with them on something, you know, just like, we have to have some kind of level of, as I say, a culture of solidarity there, you know, even among the ones we don't agree with.
It certainly seems to me that in earlier eras in bourgeois society, there was a bit more of that. Like, you can see, you know, even I'm going to reach into Marxist thinking, but I mean, you can see, for instance, Marx and Engels interacting with people that are the intellectual positions that and intellectuals who hold them that they strongly disagree with, like, for instance, their interactions with Balzac, who was a royalist. I don't know what his position was exactly. It was like a monarchist, I guess. But still, like, not seeking to ruin the person in and of itself and ruin and just, like, deny that person's ability to do intellectual work and put forward their positions. And I agree. And I think it makes sense, because I don't know why you'd want to just always be talking to people who agree with you and who have no critique to put forward of your own work. I don't know why people think that's a preferable environment, you know? I find it really boring. And it just, and as a result, the intellectual environment becomes extremely predictable. Like, you know exactly how different little fake arguments are going to go. You know, like, what point A will be, what point B will be, and you know what the synthesis will be. It's just, it's so, there's no innovation at all.
Isn't that a reflection, though, of the instability of the economic base filtering its way up? Because, and to go back to the what we were saying about the reaction to Trump, I mean, my thoughts on that, and we discussed this on the podcast, Layla, was that the paranoia and ravings about him, even though he didn't really challenge capital in the United States that much, was more based on what he might do and what might happen, and that he might stimulate some kind of unpredictability. It's the unpredictability, in my view, that the system reacts very badly to, because everything is so fragile now. Everything is based on such a thin layer of actual productive economic base in Britain and the United States now, that, like, the slightest deviation from the norm, economically, politically, or in terms of cultural norms as well, is treated with suspicion and rabid hostility, because everything has the capacity to upset that very fragile balance that does exist inside these nations now. So I think it's a case of, like, a very fragile economic base filtering its way through into the intellectual and cultural life, which leads to just both frenzied hysteria and stagnation at the same time. And the hysteria is necessary to stand in for actual intellectual production is replaced by just the hysteria to paper over the cracks of the stagnation.
Yeah, and there's such an economic incentive too to keep chopping off, all of these figures, like, because everyone is, you know, every kind of knowledge economy or whatever job is so, there's like 1,000 people going for every one of them, so. The economic incentive to just keep culling sort of like people within the elites and replacing them is there all the time as well. You know, I mean, if you're like the kind of person who wants to get a job at the New York Times or something like that, and you successfully cancel that guy, Donald McNeil, was that his name? Or whoever, somebody like that, a boomer kind of, well, that's a job opening for you, you know?
Mm.
And you may even become a little celebrity for a while if you're the person who got rid of them, you know. You can spin a few articles out of that or whatever. There's this, like, this whole, and actually the new way Anthony Giddens, like, vision of Blairism, which was sort of similar in America with Clinton. I mean, it was just sort of this set of ideas that dominated in the 90s. But that the, I guess like the Blair vision of like massively expanding education and massively expanding the creative economy and the knowledge economy and so on, that's like created this monster that we have now. And, you know, it's going to be a very hard thing to undo, because now all of these people have been sold this vision of this kind of, you know, it used to be that the only people who could really live a cosmopolitan life, have a house in the country and a townhouse and kind of fly, you know, go around the world, were like a tiny, tiny number of people within the elites, and so this very attractive vision, I think you have to recognize how attractive it is, to recognize why people are going crazy because it's falling apart. The attractive vision was sort of like the entire middle class could live like a noble. Mm. They could effectively have servants, right? People bringing them food, people taxiing them around. They could live in the middle of one of the great cities. They could fly around the world, you know, all of that stuff. Like, that is sort of the thing that's kind of falling apart to some degree. And the people who have had that dream taken away from them are not taking it well, you know. They're not going to just say, oh, well, this isn't working out, I guess I'll just go and get a manufacturing job. They're instead going to do everything else imaginable to fight this the decline of this kind of class that's in crisis.
Well, I think that certainly everything since 2008 reflected like a profound collapse of the Blair era vision. And as I said, this is something that had this inflicted on me in my degree, so I might as well use the memories of it. The idea, actually, I think it goes back before Blair. It draws ultimately from a lot of like the 60s radicalism moving into the 70s and sort of merging with mass consumer society, to the point where, like, as you were saying, Angela, this vision that that suddenly the bourgeois lifestyle of the 0.5% in British terms was suddenly going to be available to the entire middle class and part of the working class as well, if they just worked hard enough. And if we just got rid of those damn trade unions who were standing in the way, British capitalism could really take off. And of course that didn't happen. What happened is that the so-called neoliberal boom just cannibalizes the country and outsources a ton of stuff. And then everything else is done with the elastic band of credit. And so by the time we reach into 2008, there is a crisis of capitalism. And we've talked about this before, Layla, the response from 2008, and this goes right the way into the Corbyn wave that we were discussing before we started recording, that wave of radicalism that comes out of it is not working class radicalism, because the working class in Britain and the United States has already been defeated 10 years, 20 years before. What happens is you see a revolt of, in British terms, the non-productive workforce based in the public sector and the petty bourgeoisie in Britain, or a certain sector of it, revolts. And that powers initially in a small way the Miliband leadership in a very confused way. And it certainly powers the Corbyn leadership. And the problem is that the crisis that existed in 2008 hasn't produced a mass working class response. It's produced a rebellion of sections of the non-productive public sector workforce and the middle class. And you can't build a rebellion with that, or a meaningful politics with that. And I think that that's reflected in like the failures of both Sanders and Corbyn, really.
Yeah, I'm going to actually, on my Substack, I'm fascinated by Blairism in general. And one of the people I think is so interesting on Blairism is Peter Hitchens.
Peter Hitchens is always an entertaining read.
Yeah, because I think he has a really interesting way. I'll send you some stuff that I've been watching, just like interviews and some stuff I've been reading, because he talks about, like, for example, the Marxism Today, which I knew a little bit about, but like a lot of the ideas of Blairism, you know, even stuff like this idea of like pop culture being of interest to, like, sort of almost like as society became more unequal, creating a kind of culture in which there was like cultural egalitarianism. So elitism, all forms of cultural elitism would be removed, and everyone would be like writing a PhD about The Simpsons.
Like that dream.
That's very much a Marxism Today vision, actually.
Yeah.
Because wasn't their whole thing like low culture for highbrows or something like that?
If I'm remembering this rightly, like it was the Marxism Today being the official journal of the old Communist Party of Great Britain, which was liquidated by its own leadership in the middle 80s. Marxism Today, there being their journal, like, it was written for by characters like Stuart Hall, the West Indian British sociologist, and like they were very much involved in the Kinnock leadership. A lot of the intellectual, so-called intellectual stuff that was done by like Kinnock's advisor Brian Gould came from the Marxism Today. And they were very much of the view that, like, that certain changes from the Thatcher period should be embraced, and that they bought into this idea that the working class was not up for, you know, the class struggle anymore. What they wanted was to play their full part in like this wonderful festival of consumer society that was being offered by the Tories, and what the job of, like, they saw their job as being was to find a way as to turn that to what they called, I'm making the air quotes now, progressive ends. And that's exactly what, well, it's not exactly what, but that filters through into Blairism. And it filters through into the idea that, you may not be able to afford X, Y, and Z you may not be able to afford like this exact house or this exact car, but you can feel as if you can. That was like the whole thing. Like, you can really feel as if you're part of something, even though you're not. And the barriers to your participation in this culture are as big as they ever were. But we're going to work really hard at pretending as if you can.
And can I ask you as well, what is the connection between like the Fabian tradition, and would you see that as a continuation of a kind of Fabianism?
Well, the big myth that the Labour left likes to tell itself about Blair in general is that he was a complete interloper, that he was this outside force that came in and cannibalised the Labour Party. But my view on it is that he was a natural outgrowth of the Labour right wing, including the Fabian tradition, which has always been a strong part of the Labour right wing. He was, and you saw this to a degree with like a previous Labour leader like Hugh Gaitskill, who died just before the 64 election, was replaced by Harold Wilson. They'd been out of power for 13 years. So the idea of the Labour right when they've been out of power is, well, let's just adopt whatever it is that the Tories are doing and water it down and make it, you know, put a Labour spin on it. Now, that was at a time when there was a strong working class and the Soviet Union still existed. So when you get like the double whammy of like the very, very painful defeat of the industrial working class, deindustrialization, and the end of official socialism in the form of the Soviet Union, the turn of China to capitalism, well, then you've got the Labour right, completely unmoored from any working class pressure, just becomes, I mean, they were always looking for a form of social democracy that British capitalism would accept. And then when the form of it that it will accept is basically like, well, almost nothing. So what they do is they repackage like the political framework that John Major was pursuing anyway and put their own spin on it. But yeah, to conclude the thought, Blairism, Blair is just the Labour right completely unmoored and detached from all working class pressure and with no other societal model left in the world to be compared to. That's what they became.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting about Hitchin's kind of framing of it is what he says is like people who are economistic in their thinking tend to view Blair as a centrist, as watered down, and so on. And because in an economic sense, you know, because of that lack of labor militancy that you talk about, or the absence of it. But what he says is that that sort of often misses the fact that their vision, like that they were very radical in a bad way, I guess, they really did want to like remake society profoundly and remake like the human soul and kind of, you know, they wanted to, yeah, just like really fundamentally transform society in other ways, like in cultural and moral and institutional ways, and that they achieved that, like they did just like completely remake Britain in many ways.
How much of that was Blair planned that out, and how much was just an unfolding from the his economic program, which was basically the marketization of absolutely everything, cannibalization of the public sector, but a hidden cannibalization in that it was never done openly. It was always done through like outsourcing and sort of semi-privatizations. But I know Hitchens talks a lot about the sort of the moral revolution or moral counter-revolution, whichever way you want to look at it. I mean, I think that undoubtedly some of them did believe that. And for some of them, it was, I think for some of these Blairist figures, it was their, they substituted that for any and all economic attempts at like changing society had gone out of the window for them, like a long time ago, however limited it might have once been. So, and also one thing I do agree with Hitchens on is when he says, I think it's in his book, The Abolition of Britain, when he says that he calls them the left, the Blairites, whatever, had to come up with a fantasy version of the British ruling class to fight against. I mean, that's very true, because if you look at like what all the left in Britain talks about in terms of like the British ruling class, they still think it's 1935. They still think like we're still ruled over by like Neville Chamberlain and like that sort of bizarre aristocracy. Whereas in actual fact, like you look at like the British capitalism and the ruling class are actually a very dynamic thing in that that's changed. That those guys went out with like Alec Douglas Home in the 60s. But for Blair and New Labour to be considered to be radical, they had to conjure up this phantom of what the British ruling class was in order to counterpose themselves against it. Because otherwise, what are you left with? You're left with the fact that they're continuing much of John Major's economic legacy, and that doesn't look very appealing. So you have to counterpose yourself against a fantasy in order to get away with it, I think.
Yeah, I mean, this is so much that phantom. You know, this is so much so important to how the let's just call it the cultural left sort of operates, kind of cultural progressivism operates. And I think to a large degree, like a lot of some people who I think kind of have missed the point in some way say, well, you know, somebody like Trump or isn't really that important because his economic like policies were not radical and so on. But it's more that his appearance gave his opponents the opportunity to create a phantom around which they could consolidate all of the elites. You know what I mean? So, like, it's not he himself is not the important thing. It's the fact that they seized the opportunity to have an actual living person, you know, who could become this ultimate hate figure. But actually what they were doing amongst themselves was what was really important. It wasn't really about him. You also see this in this endless conversations about, like, you know, they always try to pretend that it's still the 1950s or something, and that, like,
yeah,
you know, yeah. that we still live in this, like, really traditional society or something. And it's so ridiculous. Yeah. And it's so obviously wrong. But through the repetition of it, the endless repetition over and back to each other, it's almost like in a religion, like, you know, everyone has to believe for it to work, you know, and they just repeat, you know, that this obviously completely nonsensical, you know, thing, faith belief, that we still live under this, like, traditional system. And how it really functions is just to strengthen their class solidarity and strengthen their interconnectedness and kind of sense of, I guess, moral, like, moral righteousness or having a mission. But it's a total phantom. It's just a total phantom. It doesn't even, you know, it really is like pure faith. Like they've decided that they are going to all believe in this fiction together.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to that. Like, I think, like, your comment about how people pretend like we've never left the 50s, basically, and there's been no progress on things like civil rights and, you know, women's issues and whatever have you, I think it's a big issue in the bourgeoisie, because I think that the role that these myths play in the ruling class is very important, because they can't innovate past that point. Like, the only innovation can come from the working class. And so they must continuously revisit these battles, which they have won already decades ago, you know, or as won them as far as they are able to do so as the ruling class. And they have to replay them out again and again. And to give meaning and purpose to them, to themselves as a class, like, to, I think that a lot of the ideology that we see today being produced is not geared towards the working class. It's actually geared towards primarily the petty bourgeoisie, but also to convince the ruling class itself, to give itself an explanation as to what's going on. So if I could, you know, for instance, the COVID thing, like, I really do see that as a way that the bourgeoisie is using COVID and the pandemic to explain away the economic downturn, which I mean, Alex view as just it was just a recession that started before COVID-19 came on the scene, and is as a result of the natural contradictions of capitalism. So it was just a crisis that was going to come. But, like, they use this, like, the story of the pandemic and all these different things as a way of explaining away the contradictions of capital and making themselves feel better. So I think there's a lot to that.
And do, like, you think, I really think, you know, this idea that they're kind of, there's like a sort of de-Kulakization going on, where they're just consolidating, like, a few mega corporations and sort of wiping out a lot of the rest of the economy. Is that the project?
In my view, no, I don't see it that way. Like, I think that the antagonist was always the working class. I think what happened with the pandemic, to give the short version, is that like, we had a situation where capitalism was going to fall into a recession. And that does come with, in any recession, you'll see the closing of many small businesses, for instance. That happens in any recession, because there's a lot of churn in that sector. So I think what happened in COVID is that it came on the scene at the same time as a, kind of just by coincidence, at the same time that a recession had started. So you can see that it had started from, like, many signs, like, for instance, the unemployment rate was decreasing, and then it starts slowing down months before the pandemic, before COVID-19 becomes part of the lexicon. And you also see the Fed start quantitative easing months before as well. So this is a sign that there was, yeah, there was trouble. And also, like Alex has pointed out, Trump starts tweeting and making comments about the economy in a different, maybe Alex can fill this in, but he starts like talking about how great the numbers are and trying to distract people from the fact that unemployment numbers have stagnated and are no longer on the decrease months before COVID hits. So my view is instead that the lockdowns hit at a time where, which kind of concealed the recession. And I do think that the ruling class really did think that COVID-19 was going to be like this big deadly pandemic, which would kill off a significant portion of the working class. And you can see this in like editorials from like Bill Gates and all of these big like bourgeois people. And so they reacted like very violently, and they applied these lockdowns to the biggest extent that they could, which really just meant that they would never shut down productive activity, like the productive labor, commodity production, and also realization. They could only shut down the unproductive segments of the economy, which does include like a lot of services, which are primarily provided by smaller businesses. So I think that's more so what happened. Like, and then once the lockdowns kind of started, because it served such a useful function to explain away the contradictions of capital, also it had different political advantages, like with getting Trump out, I think that was a big motivation. It just kind of like, it took on a political economy of its own, and it just like, and that's what's brought us here today. Long story short.
If that makes sense. Do you think that, is there basically not going to be any return? Like, do you think that it's just fundamentally reshaped the economy, and that's the way, and that will define, like, how the years or decades ahead after the pandemic?
No, I actually feel like this will not fundamentally reshape the economy, because I feel like this merely it may accelerate some trends that were already in place. So I think that's probably a better way of looking at it. So me and Alex are big. We find Lenin's theory of imperialism really helpful for understanding what's going on. And so what we'll see is a continued consolidation of small capitals into big capitals, and a increasing importance of finance capital that will just continue. I think what the pandemic did more so is reveal the lack of working class organization and strength, and which kind of makes this era kind of a time of pure bourgeois politics. And so what we're seeing is like this, these draconian impositions on our civil liberties and rights, because there's no one to fight and defend them anymore. And that used to be the working classes. And so it's a little hard to accept. Like, it's been hard for me to accept that this is actually just how capitalism is in the absence of a militant working class. But yeah, like it, to answer your question, I don't think that this will reshape the economy in any way that it wouldn't have eventually came to, in absence of the subjective factor of the working classes rising up and, you know, kind of imposing their irrational, like imposing rationality to the system. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's mostly been an acceleration, but it's been a devastating acceleration. Like,
And that's it for part one of our interview with Angela Nagel. Tune in on our Patreon page next week. We'll be putting up part two, which will cover everything from the coronavirus outbreak and the response of the Irish government to it, to the economic trajectory of Ireland since independence, and the uses and misuses of art in this late period of capitalism. Be sure to join us there, and I hope you enjoy the program.